Well, a hush has come over the crowd, so I guess that means we can actually start on time today. Welcome, everyone. It's good to see such a good turnout for this inaugural event of this year's University Colloquium Series. We don't have posters up and about yet because we managed to negotiate the last slot just a few days ago. So posters will be out soon. Keep your eyes open. We've got a really interesting series this year with a number of interesting speakers, both from our own faculty, but also from off campus. Today, we're very happy to have Anne-Marie Early with us, and I'm sorry I'm talking about you with my back to you, but we've worked on enough committees, I think I can get away with this. But Anne-Marie has been on the faculty here at EMU on the Master's in Counseling program since, I got my cheat sheet here, 2004. So many of you, I'm sure, know her already. But for those of you who don't, she's did her doctoral work at Fuller Graduate School of Psychology, finished a PhD in 1999, has done a variety of practice and academic work since then, coming here in 2004. She's a licensed therapist with special expertise in attachment theory and emotion-focused therapy. She was the director of the Master's in Counseling program for a number of years, a very popular teacher, not only here on campus, but off campus as well. She does a lot of trainings in continuing education opportunities in places around the country, really. She's authored or co-authored a number of articles and a book, and I better read that title or I'll mess it up, Integrating the New Science of Love and a Spirituality of Peace, Becoming Human Again. And she co-authored that with one of our other stellar faculty members. So very much looking forward to hearing this talk today. It's based on her sabbatical research last year on the wisdom of native healing practices. Anne-Marie, thanks very much. Thank
you. Well, it's really good to be with you this afternoon. And I'm going to do this different than I've done presentations before because I'm different, and I want to share that with you today. I've been changing over the last couple of years, both within my personal life and my professional work. And what I noticed was happening in the profession, that the way I used to do therapy tended to get people stuck. And I needed to shift my way of practicing and being in the world to allow embodiment and experiential practice to speak. That was an easy transition for me, because it meant reorienting the way that I work and the way that I see the world. But neuroscience was helpful here because it helped as it was getting applied to clinical practice, showing that there are different ways of knowing. And these different ways of knowing have different functions, and they move the process along in different ways. So I found the work of Eugene Genland and felt sensing, and felt sensing is this interoceptive process where you can go inward and actually see what's going on the inside before your mind knows. And what Genland said is that if you do this felt sensing process, that you will be able to walk your way forward into knowing from intuition first, being translated later into language. And that was the key in therapy of what moved the process forward. Didn't matter what theory you were using, you had to be able to go inward and do that piece of work. So I started working with Genlin and writing and talking as I was weaving it into my life. And then I had this opportunity to put in a sabbatical proposal. And so I did something a little bit risky, and I'll be honest to you, the committee said to me, we'll give you the sabbatical, we're not quite sure what you're doing, but we'll give it to you. Because I wrote it from a particular place. I wrote it from the right hemisphere. The intuitive, wise, inner knowing that has been my guide throughout my entire life, but does not fit easily in academia or in the clinical world. And I read a book that helped me to make the shift, Ian McGilchrist's book, The Master and His Emissary. And he talks about the distinction between the right and left hemisphere, the right being the open, scanning, nonverbal, intuitive, and we put other words on it, procedural knowing, bottom-up processing. But it's this knowing that is without language, but very wise. It's distinct from the left hemisphere, which is the more languaged, categorical, representational, which is a key, and narrowing. It's not that we want one or the other. It's about who's the boss and who follows. Well, since the modern era, we've allowed the boss to be the left hemisphere, I think to our great detriment. And we have ourselves tied in a knot, one that I'm not sure we know how to get out of. So for me to return to my own wise inner knowing that guided me, the place from which spirit speaks, it felt refreshing to actually have language to say, this is the wise knowing place. And yes, we need the language, but it comes after the experience. And so I wrote my sabbatical proposal saying, I want to interview native healers. I had one contact and the door closed, and I had no other possibility for how to do that project. But what I knew about my sabbatical is that I was giving myself a year to step into unknowing. My goal for my sabbatical was to not bring with me all of this information that I carry with my degrees and my training, but to truly step into the absolutely frightening place of not knowing. And what I knew inside of myself is I could not learn one more therapy modality because I would cheat. I would bring everything that I knew with me. So what was delivered to me during my sabbatical, where I rested and walked my woods, I had to regulate myself so that I would not become anxious that I was not producing what I was supposed to produce. But what McGilchrist says in his book that is so important is that genius, Einstein's most amazing revelations came from the right hemisphere and were later translated by the left. So I allowed myself this luxurious landscape, tolerating my anxiety, and I had the possibility of taking a course, a 350-hour face-to-face course, add about another 100 face-to-face hours on top of that, in something called integrative energy medicine. And it's a way of sensing into felt sensing, but not using language the way that I had been trained. And for me, not using my eyes. I was trained to pay attention to subtle energy that flows within and around the body in ways that I did not believe were possible. And it was the scariest thing that I've ever had to do, because I had to let go and trust something that I didn't know if I could do. Now, my trainers, who are sitting in the audience today, were very patient with me, and they allowed me space to practice, and they can see in ways that I can't see, which makes it even more threatening. But to be able to learn to sense in differently to the world around me. That was my first lesson in unknowing. My second lesson was I finally made the decision that I would not speak removed from my voice anymore. And as a consequence, that means I will not write removed from my voice anymore, which puts my place sitting in front of you very tenuous. Because to write from the third person is what we are trained to do. But I was committed, I would not do that anymore. So I began reading into autoethnography, trying to see, is there a way for me to blend what I know with my own voice? So I read this book, this little section to you, Autoethnography, Understanding Qualitative Research. If our task as researchers, as social scientists, is to study the social lives of humans, then we cannot relegate elements of human lives or experiences to the periphery, nor can we bracket our ways and our lives and experiences that are intertwined with our research projects and participants. I did not believe in the self-regulation, guilt, pain, the denial of pleasure, and the silencing of voice that was required to produce so-called proper academic subjectivities. Nor did I think that the worst sin I could commit as a researcher was to be too personal. I valued the personal, and I wanted to include, even to feature it, in my work. If our desire is to research social life, then we must embrace a research method that, to the best of its or our ability, acknowledges and accommodates mess and chaos, uncertainty and emotion. So I won't remove from my own voice. I'm learning to sense differently into the world than I ever thought was possible, stretching my mind way beyond what I could even imagine. And then all of a sudden, this opportunity crossed my path. There was a team going to Peru. And I thought to myself, could this be it? So I wrote an application and I was accepted on the team. And I wrote in my application, would you please, please, please let me interview native healers while we're there? Well, I didn't know who was hosting us, but they asked, and the answer was yes. They'd even try to set up some interviews. It was on and then it was off. I put my first IRB proposal in with the help of Cherie Hammond, and I was on my way. And then I thought to myself, what am I doing? I have no idea what I'm doing. I've never done anything like this before. So my colleague Tammy LeDrew, who used to be a National Geographic photographer, had some skill. Why not do a documentary as well? Okay, why not? So we called up Paulette Moore. And Paulette, in her gracious way, met with us. And my colleague Tammy has experience, so she could talk the language. But I was so forthright as to say, can you give me the 10 easy steps to executing and doing a documentary in the dummy style? And she did. I learned more than I ever want to know about DSLR cameras, external mics, SD cards, Lydia.com, Adobe Premiere Pro. But she sat and she talked and we listened. But then something happened. She stood up from her seat and she said, wait a minute. And I said, we said, what? She ran back to her apartment. 15 minutes later, she came back with 3 bags of 10 seeds each. She said, these are for you. They're third generation, 850-year-old seeds. And I share this, what she wrote later for me. And this right here is that third generation, 850-year-old squash from my garden. Joy Shelby and Peter Rasmussen are deeply trusted collaborators with the Bad River Tribe and story keepers, tellers. Their son Finn is a 10-year-old, and his spiritual godfather is Mike Wiggins Jr., chair of the Bad River Band, and the Finn's family lives on the edge of the reservation. I call Finn one of the wisest and most important people I know because he's been witness to the massive mining fight and the flow of multicultural warriors that have gathered at the family's table to strategize and celebrate. Finn watched the world's largest open pit mine, funded by the Koch brothers, get shut down by the spirit power of the people. And he created a clay pot to carry the time traveler seeds. Joy creates gardens to feed body, history, cultural, and will work with Bad River beginning in the fall. She is a prophet. The seeds you received are third generation from the seeds that Winona LaDuke carried to Harvest Camp in 2013. They were discovered in a clay pot, preserved in honey at a construction site at White Pine Reserve. Those who receive the seeds are asked to save them after the squash is harvested and give them to others, at least 10 at a time. It would be great for the community to hear where those seeds travel. It gives them energy. So in that gifting from Paulette that just spontaneously happened, I would say the first thread was woven into the cloth that became this experience of traveling in Peru. It would be a lot easier to sit in front of you and give you a PowerPoint presentation that is linear and laid out with really clear points and to explain it to you and to describe it to you. But I sit in front of you today vulnerably, and I choose to present the material in a different way. What I present to you today is my first attempt at about a sixth grade level of doing Adobe Premiere Pro. And I have a 15-minute video to introduce you to the people and to the experiences that I had with the healers, because to just extrapolate their stories or their wisdom could not do justice what they passed on to me. That there's something important, there is something desperately important as we are at the frontier of science, pushing us towards deepest into epigenetics and out to everything being connected, quantum mechanics, quantum entanglement. And in the literature, it is showing up that, guess what? These ancient traditions are the things that are the pathway forward, especially for people who have suffered horrific trauma. Mindfulness, meditation, acupuncture, energy systems, things that I did not learn in graduate school. And my curiosity in this project was, what would it be like to take the cutting edge of science, to jump back over the modern era, and find people who through all of this have carried their tradition for hundreds of years and potentially millennia, using the wisdom of the right hemisphere as their guide and then translating it to the left. So I hope you enjoy, to the best of my ability, this video that I made, and then I'll talk about the themes that I'll be working with and then take your questions at the end. Let me first introduce Dr. Teo Paredes-Yapiz. Dr. Paredes is trained as an anthropologist and archaeologist and served terms as governor over the wider Cusco region, including Machu Picchu and into the jungle, and served as a congressman. He is founding director of Pokankanchai Foundation, a nonprofit dedicated to the preservation, study, and rescue of pre-Incan archaeological sites, their ancient knowledge, and healing techniques. Dr. Paredes, or Don Teo, or Dr. Teo, as he was often called, is a healer. Dr. Paredes was our host for our two-week immersion into the very landscape of Peru. He traveled us to key healing sites high up on sacred mountains, through the archaeological remains of ancient sites, and down into the lower world of the jungle. This is Don Julian, a healer that traveled 11 hours to welcome us to Peru through a despacho ceremony. Don Julian follows his healing path through the lineage of both his mother and father, back through the generations. He gave us his teachings that I will share with you today, his wife's beautiful weaving, of which the Peruvians are so well known, and his story. Don Carlos is a self-trained healer that learned his craft through the art of deep listening to key places of healing and through transmission in his dreams. He felt called from early childhood to follow the healing path, and we were gifted with his unique eye into who we really are. Dr. Fernand Poulin is a stateside healer who is the developer of integrative energy medicine. He is a chiropractor by training and a healer by calling. He was called to healing through his grandparents, who had the gift of stopping hemorrhaging, and has been trained in various healing traditions since choosing to follow his call. Dr. Poulin was co-pilot for our travels and participant in the healing journey we all voyaged on. We traveled as a team of 13, each called to witness and learn from the teachings and through our embodied experiences. That was one of Dr. Paredes's first teachings, that it was not by mistake or coincidence that we had gathered for this time as we embarked on 2 weeks of life-altering experiencing.
We were hosted with generous hospitality that held us through our travels and healed in body and mind, each differently, but all changed forever by our experience.
Right now, I can call the ancient spirit of the mountain to come and to bring into us the power that blends with the Mother Earth, give all the colors to life. And when life comes, it's the rain and the sun with the rainbow that give colors to the flowers. And that's what. Niña, al recordar en tus ojos tan fijos en mí, veo el mar, la playa y el sol, horizontes que no conocí. Ni tanto reclama tu voz y yo, la flor de tu piel. Esta noche, niña, te veo llegar. Tam, tam, yo sé que te llevo dentro. Porque tu canto y mi verso siempre te quieren nombrar. Niña, te dejo todos mis sueños. Me voy esta noche lejos para poderte olvidar.
The idea to interview native healers came more as a whisper than a plan, as I read through and became fascinated by the emerging literature about the importance of attending to the power of the right hemisphere. The non-languaged, yet unformed bubblings of our wise inner knowing is distinct from the languaged preformed knowing of the left. What I realized was that in therapy, change often happened quite unexpectedly from these unformed emergences, what has been referred to as the felt sense. I'd been working with this space more intentionally for the last few years, but I felt called to move beyond embodiment into a way of knowing that has a long history held by many native healers. As you can imagine, healers speak through action more than word, as their teachings are a transmission, not an explanation. I offer here just the first layer of their wisdom, with many more layers I have yet to unfold, as I witnessed the amazing interplay of life and landscape, giving voice to the very potentials we now call our frontier. The very land we stood on was a strong influence in the healings and had an alive, collaborative role as both animate actor and container. Knowledge of their literal landscape was carried by each healer as they shared about the sacred mountains, the apus, earth, Pachamama, and all of the elements in a live collaboration and conversation. I present to you now the exploratory themes that emerged from my interviews and my experiences with healing, and how this might inform counseling. My questions came from my sense that we've lost something in our modern era that can be reclaimed by making contact between scientific advances and pre-modern ways of knowing. I invite you to listen with openness and curiosity to this material, holding your own tradition in mind. What would it mean to listen into ways of knowing from within our own tradition? Would listening deeply into the often wordless or difficult to describe landscape of long-held teachings of wisdom make any difference to how we live, how we work, how we embody health, and how we heal?
And one of the things that he thinks is more important is to bring
kind of joy in your heart that you have to be, in order to be well, you have to bring joy in your heart. Okay? Manan yakikunchu manan. In my understanding, what he's saying is that we should keep the balance between us and the Mother Earth. And this is why he has been doing this despacho. This despacho is where our worries, our mainly fears, is put in there and being cleansed in order us not to be on a stress. That will be the answer. That's what he's doing, that we should not be, literally he tells me we should not be worried. That's the key. Doesn't matter what you eat, what you do, if you do this worrying, you are going to get later on into imbalance. Okay, so from time to time it's good to honoring the earth, honoring whatever, but the main thing that you have to do is don't worry. Don't worry.
Yeah, like you really come here as a foreigner. You don't know much the culture, you don't know the language, you don't know the culture, mainly how we understand this planet, the energy, the earth. This is what we do.
Y además la forma de vida que ellos llevan y nosotros llevamos.
And the way of life you do down there is different.
Ellos viven de acuerdo a la tecnología.
We live according to the technology.
Nosotros vivimos de acuerdo a la naturaleza y la energía cósmica, la madre tierra y la vida.
Mother Earth and life.
O sea, lo que acá hay, ¿no? La madre tierra, la
mother
vida actual, el cosmos.
Life and cosmos.
La serpiente, el
serpent,
puma, el cóndor.
Puma and cóndor.
El amor,
love,
sabiduría,
no knowledge.
El trabajo,
work.
Y tres formas de trabajo.
And three kinds of work.
Cusco,
our neighbor.
Esto la parte de Brasil, esto el Ecuador, Colombia.
Ecuador, Brasil, Colombia.
Y esto viene a ser Chile y esto Bolivia, Argentina. Esos son los
the four cuatro. Regions. From here where we come. Mm.
Y siempre manejamos pues, los siete colores que es el arcoíris.
And we always work with the seven colors, which is one.
Nosotros siempre manejamos tres cosas, su pasado, el presente y el futuro.
We always work with the past, present and future.
Y siempre manejamos la variedad.
And always we work with the complementary things.
Lo que es el varón y la mujer.
What is woman, man.
Y damos gracias a la madre tierra.
We always express our gratitude to the Mother Earth.
Entonces ahí adquirimos la energía, el panteísmo.
Then is when we begin to really connect ourselves and get the energy.
Another theme was form versus formlessness. I question the role of the literal objects that were used, noticing that our tangible use of language tries to touch the intangible. While these healers had an ordinary acceptance of the intangible with more literal tangibility in their use of objects, landscape, and their very use of self.
Why is the healer so involved?
I think there are various variations of working this way. I don't think the shaman, all shamans take it. I don't think so. I don't think it's all traditions that will work in the same way. And so by shocking the system, there are various ways of shocking the system. One is to bring the client back into the trauma itself. That shocks the system in the same way it started, and that's what liberates the field.
You say it breaks the field.
It breaks the field of the wounds. Like cures like, so you have to bring it back into that same experience or that same tone resonance. Some shamans will take it on, but they take it on with consciousness.
Right, absolutely.
They know the form of that wound as they take it in. It's like eating an apple. They know the form of the apple. Okay. So by knowing the form of that wound as they take it in, they know exactly how to digest it and to eliminate it. So they don't take it on to metabolize it in the same way. They take it on to extrapolate it from the client, and at the same time, to break the, they will call it the demons, to break the resonance, the frequency of that form into a neutral form. So.
I have another question. He says for us to not worry and to stay connected to the land, Mother Earth in particular. What would he want us to take back to our homes and share from his wisdom?
Ima pahkang munangki pai haparamu wasimi hojoruna warminishan angkaitan no kayachankan peru nyahtapi pai chayikero nishan ima tangkang alimi nishan pai haparamu ahay Estados Unidos mant.
No pai ko esa wai tenas pa nos kantar. I mean a pesteiko. I mean a pobre skeiko. Chita rico na ang kuto naiko. Ay te kente I ma ko sa icha pa skulara ang kini ka tera ko na pa yung na ko na skula ko na yung daro sa pero ko ay icha pa skapa tembo ma yan na pa ikawaso yachas to rico sa.
He says, that's interesting. He says that if you go to his land, you are going to see how poor are they are, that they don't have roads, that they don't have schools, that they have to be asking to the government or some other people for help to improve whatever they need. However, they don't worry. They are happy with what they have. And that's you should what you should carry to be happy with what you are and what you have.
Beautiful. A long-held tradition of healing passed through the generations, extending back centuries, possibly millennia. A fluid appreciation of surroundings, landscape as healer and container, for and with us, through sacred reciprocity, the use of healing ritual as vehicle, and the conscious use of self. Attention to energy, flow, movement, and perception, and an intentional act of paying attention and expanding awareness. A possible way forward as we learn to extend our sense of self beyond the boundaries of our skin? This is my beginning place, from which I will embark as I continue to explore the power of Native practices for healing.
Embarking on this experience, I didn't even know who we were traveling with. And not only is Dr. Paredes an archaeologist who's actually found a Machu Picchu behind Machu Picchu, and that amazing seven-chakrad sun is on an excavation site that he's done for the past 5 years. An archaeologist, an anthropologist trained at Bryn Mawr, former governor over Cusco and the larger region, a congressman, and a healer. So you can imagine entering these sites, we were not there as tourists. We were there every moment he was talking with us, with cameras on, he was very tolerant. So my idea of interviewing healers really was more of an encounter with a people, with a tradition, and with a landscape. And everything was a learning experience. If I imagine into my fantasy that I was going to interview healers and how silly that really was, honestly bringing out my IRB form and having them sign it felt very strange, though they have amazing signatures. They're incredible and elaborate. Because it was really their ability to see in and to name without even knowing who I was with accuracy. My teammates knew it and they would laugh with accuracy as I was asking these questions. Hours of videotape, so much so that my computer was full when I got back. iCloud was full and I needed more storage, and my iPhone was full. And most of it was scrambled or in the wrong format because I had no idea what I was doing. Thank goodness for Tammy knowing what she was doing. That's most of her footage that you see. And then thinking about what do I do with this? So the themes that stand out to me that I hope to work with and mold and play around with really, again, are not linear. They're a conversation. But they might fall out something like this. In the literature, there's a lot of talk these days about receptive states of awareness. How our thinking brain gets in the way, it's actually what stops and creates trauma. And how creating what Stephen Porges calls is the optimal level of arousal in the window of tolerance, where there's enough going on so that you're online, but not so much that you're flooded. Social engagement system is where we want to be. In trauma, what happens is that window narrows and it takes a lot to titrate and open it up. These practices that take us back to pre-modern ways of knowing tend to be the pathway that open up that window the best. So receptive states of awareness, I would use the word receptivity. The healers and working in this landscape, there was an awareness that we needed to be in a place to receive. They talk about focalized versus defocalized knowing, very similar to right and left hemisphere, and that you want to evoke the state of being in a defocalized place to receive. They also would talk about the importance of that relationship between the healer and the one who was being healed. And I kept using the word pedestrian. It all felt incredibly ordinary. We're going to go do a ceremony and a healing, and then we're going to wash dishes. Everything felt fluid. So this receptive states of awareness fed into relationship. And you heard some of the healers talking about it. Relationship to yourself. And that was the one teaching from Don Julian. He said he could see worry on us. No illness, but worry. And the way we carry ourselves, we will make ourselves sick. So relationship to ourselves, relationship to one another, and relationship to the literal environment. We were in Cusco, 11,000 feet, a little bit higher, I think. And the actual tangibility of almost everybody that we met, they were connected to the land. It wasn't just the healers. They knew their sacred mountains. They knew the landscape and the tradition and the history that was under their feet. And at one point, Dr. Paredes was talking to us about the importance of integration between thinking and feeling and integrating within the person. And that when you're out of balance with any part within yourself, with others, or the larger landscape, he talked about it has global consequences. And so this importance of relationship, not only with ourselves and with others, but with the land, was very important. So receptive states of awareness, relationship, then the power of ritual. These long-held patterns of engaging, and I don't have it on tape because it was one of these conversations that we would just be meandering and talking. And we were in the Sacred Valley in Pisac. And I had just found out who this man was who was hosting us, and I was very embarrassed because I kept asking these silly, well, yes, yes, I used to be governor over this area. Oh, yes, yes, yes. And I said, tell me about trauma and healing trauma. And he said, you need to shock the system, Anne-Marie. And there can be positive traumas as well as negative traumas, but you have to meet that. And you heard Dr. Poulin talk about that. You have to meet the same energy to break it. And these healers would talk about vibration and resonance and energy systems, these things that I think are right at the current cutting edge of science that really blow my mind. These native healers just talked to us as if we knew that that was the reality. And they used ritual, things like the rattle. And when I came home, I was reading, and here, lo and behold, part of the reason the rattle can be used is to put someone into a receptive state of awareness, a trance state. So these objects that I could name as funny are actually very purposeful and very useful for getting to the very place I would love to do in my own work. So receptivity, relationship, ritual, and then reciprocity. There was this clear sense that we were not passive in having something done to us. We were participant in and with. As you go, healing would happen. As you were in a landscape, we were called to pay attention. And Dr. Paredes would talk as if he was a Jungian analyst sometimes. He would talk about the ego and having to get past the ego and how do you actually become a receptive vehicle. And I thought to myself as my worlds were mixing in that moment, I have a lot to learn. I have a lot to learn by listening differently and having a different kind of perspective, a different way of seeing, a different way of entering not knowing, which isn't that funny? The very thing I set out in my sabbatical to do for myself was the place that these healers were asking us to go. And at one very interesting moment, we had gotten up at 1 a.m. and we drove up the wrong mountain. I kid you not, in the dark. Their roads are about that big, perilous cliffs. We had to turn around, big trucks coming at us, waterfalls, washed out roads. My colleague Teresa had given me a rosary. It was the one time I thought about, I didn't even know how to use it, but I thought, this is the time. This is the time. We ended up on the sacred mountain, Tres Cruces, one of two places, according to Dr. Paredes, where you can look at the sun face to face for 25 minutes and not burn your eyes. We stood there on the sacred mountain receiving more teaching from him, and he walked up to me and he said, he didn't even know my name, just the lady with the camera, when you move from here, your heart, it will flow. You have too much blah, blah, blah. That's what he told me, too much blah, blah, blah. When you move from your heart, it will flow. So this experience of traveling with, participating, being with, this incredible appreciation of the land, of landscape as container and healer. And I want to end with this, and then I'll take your questions. It was the healers that I learned from, but the very people in Cusco that I met had something that was amazing. They had kindness and joy in that deep, deep, deep down place on the inside. You could see it and feel it. And any of you who have traveled in countries with desperate poverty, where people have that light, you know what I'm talking about. And I thought to myself, if you could package this and bring this home, this is better than any pill that we could take. But it's cultivated. It's cultivated through receptive states, relationship, ritual, and the reciprocity, the sacred reciprocity, with the very landscape that surrounds us. So I'm going to end with a quote. But I also want to bring it home. Because ever since saying what I am doing, you whisper in my ear and you say, you know what? In the Mennonite tradition, my grandpa planted based on the moon. Do you know they used to throw salt over their shoulder? You know, my grandma carries with her the tradition of healing plants. But it's always whispered in my ear. What would happen if we don't just go over there, but we begin to listen differently here, to the very place that we're at, the traditions that are whispered behind closed doors? Would it make any difference to how we live and how we heal? Would it make any difference? So I'll end with this, a quote by Stephen Herod Booner. A solution to the poverty and illness in our world lies within the ancient capacity for individuals to travel in sacred territory, to reconnect with the sacredness of the earth, and to develop their own capacity, a birthright of being human, to evoke the holy and once again sit in the council of all life. So thank you for listening to my story. I think we have about 10 minutes for questions. If you have any questions, I think Lois has a mic, and I'd be happy to the best of my ability to answer anything that you might have.
Yes, I would say that anybody that's sitting close here to this one and want to come right up to the stationary mic, feel free. We have the roving mic here for questions.
Would you be so kind to give examples of what the healer meant by shocking the trauma, meeting the energy with the energy?
I would love to answer that question, but he's sitting in the audience. Do you want to explain, Dr. Poulin?
Well, when we begin to perceive the subtler aspects of our existence, meaning the energetics that surrounds the body, that's also inside the body, what begins to happen when there is a trauma, a shock exists at the level of nervous system that emanates also an energetic field around itself. And so that shock being lodged in the tissue of the nervous system also has a field that reflects the experience. It doesn't only help to just talk about it, but one has to have access to go directly to the energetic trauma, the energetic shock, to meet it face to face, and also to facilitate it to unwind. And the unwinding also causes the emotional release, but the emotional release doesn't always unwind the shock. And so doing this particular type of work allows for the practitioner to meet directly where the shock is energetically, but also have a presence of compassion for the client to dive into the emotional component of the trauma. And simultaneously, the emotional trauma begins to lift, as well as the energetic shock begins to unwind and leave the central nervous system. So that's my answer.
That was a fantastic answer. I'll have you travel around with me everywhere.
Other questions?
I was really intrigued by the way you talked about the place-based nature of not just things that are internal but also external, talking about landscape, and the connection between the old and the new. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, I'm coming from the background as an architect and visual artist, thinking about the way that we shape space and shape ritual, so not just reconnecting, but also developing new ways of being in that. I'm just curious to hear what your response to be with how do we make things sacred, or as we not just look back and reconnect with the old, but also make new ways that you found that was involved in your work.
What a great question. I'm not sure I'm going to have a very good answer. But maybe where I would begin with an answer is to say, I knew this But I experienced it in this landscape in a different way. There is a way to pay attention and to listen that is deeper, wiser, more direct than the talking part of me. And so I can imagine in, as an architect or someone who's working with landscape, that it would, from this perspective, take a receptive state. The ability to be in relationship with, not doing something to, but listening to that landscape. Being able to see that the spaces want certain things or ask for certain things. So it's one thing, you can put something down on something or you can let something evolve from. And this sacred reciprocity, that wouldn't it be beautiful if our landscapes and our buildings were a conversation with? One of the things that I committed to myself after this year, that I'm not going to ever do PowerPoint again, I hope I can stick to that. And the other one is, I will no longer talk about, I will talk from. Wouldn't it be amazing if the spaces we created evoked that as well? So it's not just talking that does that, but the literal landscapes that we surround ourselves with. Wouldn't that be amazing if you did that?
So what was it like for you when you returned to your office, when you walked on campus, when you came back to what was before?
What a beautiful question. I had this amazing interlude. Well, living in the unknown, I feel like I trust the unfolding in a way that I didn't before. So I am meant to be here in my office on this campus now. And I had this, because my computer was full, I couldn't work with any of this material, and I still can't. It's in the odd file forms that I cannot figure out, but Marty said they're going to help me figure it out. So I couldn't do anything. So what I did, Judy, is I chose to write. But I wrote memoir writing. I wrote about my trip to Peru from my true voice. And that experience of taking that world and bringing it into this world, and I think writing in a different way, through story and through encounter, helped me to put my year, because it's filled with my whole year, put my year in a place where I could hold it and also step into my office in a different way and step into my teaching. I mean, you know, I do PowerPoints. That is what I do. I threw most of them away to create space on my computer so I could actually write an iBook author. So it feels different, but I feel like I'm in my skin, and no longer will I talk about, but I will talk from. And it feels a little risky and dangerous to do that, especially in a place like this, in an academic context. But it feels right, and so I'm willing to do it.
Yeah. I have a question that feels almost like a follow-up to the previous one. So what do you need from us, from the EMU community, in order for you to be able to continue this change, this metamorphosis, perhaps?
Maybe I would begin by saying thank you. I mean, I had a semester. I could not have done in a semester. I needed a year, and it was not easy, and I had been saving for 8 years enough money to take a year off. I needed that year. But you granted me the sabbatical, and you gave me space. And I knew in my heart, I mean, I was anxious about production. I mean, I had to produce stuff. But I knew in my heart the essence of this community, and I knew it would be okay. So my focus of attunement, you know, which is where my research is, and resonance, and then regulating my anxiety, was an important part for me on this journey. So I don't feel like I need anything from EMU, but I would like to say something. When we make sabbaticals about not teaching but producing, we are living from the left hemisphere, and we are cheating ourselves because we are representing the old material over and over and over again. What would it be like to be a community on the cutting edge who does pedagogy different? Not that we get rid of all of that fabulous thinking that we do, but we allow spontaneous, creative, emergent places, sabbatical being one of them, so that people can live into inspiration and then speak from that place? What would that be like if we didn't just grant it, but we actually made it a requirement of the people who go on sabbatical? Not only would we be an amazing place, I think we would be an amazing place on the cutting edge, and we would have to keep people out of our doors. So, not really a direct answer to your question, but my dream.
So we have time for one more for Anne-Marie.
A medium-sized question and a very small one.
Okay.
The medium-sized question is actually a follow-on, because I was struck by your saying that these healers spoke from within a place where people were aligned with a particular way of being. So Jane Ellen's question about what do you need from this place, I want to expand to a question about how do you speak from and engage in a conversation of speaking from when that may or may not be the way people think in this space, in this culture, in this country? And the small question is, was it only coincidental that the healers that you were dealing with were all males?
Mm-hmm. It was what was given to me, and I took what I was given. And I think that's a much larger question. So it was just coincidental. They were all through Dr. Paredes, so they were his contacts, and he was my translator for the whole time. If I'm right, at reading where we're going, we will eventually correct ourselves. McGilchrist argues we may actually be rewiring our brains, and there could be some serious consequences by living the way that we are. But I think we will correct ourselves. And I think beginning to speak this way, I do think people will think I'm a little bit odd, and I'm probably gonna get challenged. But that deep, wise, knowing place on the inside knows the truth of what I speak. And so I feel comfortable speaking from that place and making it a conversation, because I have something to learn in whatever's being shared with me in that moment. And I would say all three of my trainers who sat with me, I mean, you guys, I had ninja butterflies, and I was a dreadful student. I mean, I was not a happy camper last year having to do all of this because I had no control over what was happening. I learned the power of presence through them, where by their ability to stay inside of themselves and centered, even when I was a dysregulated mess, it helped me to find my center. And so what more could I hope for than, as I continue to learn in this and live into this, to find my true center, and then whatever happens around me, it'll be okay. But to hope for people to be able to move from this more natural place, to find healing from this more natural place, to engage the world from this more natural place. I believe this is the healing that the world is looking for. I believe it can come from all different kinds of directions and ways, and I believe this unique place has its own voice to offer if we're courageous enough to do so. That's it. I see Katie's, do you want to do, I see one, okay. One more question? Okay, all right. So we'll take one last question.
Just drawing on what you just said, you just self-described a point in your process as having been a dysregulated mess. And I'm just wondering if you would have been able to come to the point you're at if you had not entered somewhere as a dysregulated mess. Yeah.
I love control, and so it would have been really fun to learn a modality where I could have controlled the process, and I'm still in that place. I mean, I'm still learning. I'm still in a class where I'm learning how to do this, and it is incredibly uncomfortable. But being presenced with people who can tolerate that with me, but letting myself learn to regulate not from the outside in, but from the inside out. That's the difference that makes the difference. And so in this, that was the unknowing state. Going to Peru, having no idea if there was anybody to interview, was incredibly anxiety-producing, and not managing that. Waiting for something to show up for my sabbatical proposal was amazingly anxiety-producing. Making the choice that I will never write from the third person again, it's my very existence sitting in front of you. Very anxiety-producing. But that wise place, and I call it spirit, where spirit speaks to me from the inside out and has since I was very small. If I speak truthfully, it has been my guide, but I've kept it quiet. Wouldn't it be amazing to really begin to blend that voice with who I am as a professional and from that place speak? Who knows what'll show up? We're done for today. Thank you so much. Appreciate your being here.
Thank you, Anne Marie, for a very thought-provoking presentation.